Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Carrie Adloyd. How do we grieve for someone? How does it change and evolve as we get older? My dad died when I was 15, and it took me many, many years to be able to express what I had gone through. So I decided to create Griefcast, a chance to talk, share, and laugh about the weirdness of grief and death. But with comedians, so it's not that depressing, I promise. Each time I talk to a different comedian about their own personal experience of grief, as we remember someone that they have lost along the way. Whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club, this is a chance to talk about the peculiar human process of death. Welcome to Griefcast.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, griefsters. I hope you're having an okay week. There's been a lot of chatter on the Twitter this week at the Griefcast, because I hate to be the one to remind you if you are doing your best to avoid it, but this Sunday is Father's Day. So I, like many of you, are trying to do my best to avoid it, but those marketing emails, and I will hold my hands up fully and say it is not as bad as Mother's Day. I think that is a really difficult one to avoid, but they are catching up, the old Father's Day emails. So I was wondering if we could do what we did for Mother's Day, which is just, you know, have a hashtag on the Twitter that if you are feeling really crappy or it's just brought up loads of stuff for you. And last time the hashtag I invented also was the same hashtag as like kind of video game, and it got a bit confusing. So I thought, why not just do the hashtag you are not alone? If you are stuck on Sunday and feeling really rubbish, just use the hashtag you are not alone, or hashtag griefcast, or at the griefcast, and I'll do my best to retweet the ones that I see. And if you do see ones that people haven't replied to and you are feeling the same, please do reply and reach out. The Twitter, bizarrely for Twitter, is actually a really nice corner of Twitter where everyone is very helpful. So if you do have any questions or worries or queries or things, I'm always happy to retweet stuff and see if we can find you a helpful solution. And I hope that Sunday passes as well as it can do. I will be sort of avoiding it as well, so we'll all be thinking of each other. This week I'm talking to writer and broadcaster Sally Hughes. Sally is a regular columnist for The Guardian Weekend, where she has her own beauty column. She's the author of Pretty Honest and has just released her new book called Our Rainbow Queen. She also has her own YouTube series and is a regular on BBC Radio 4 Woman's Hour. Sally came in to talk to me about her father, who died just after her son was born, one of her closest friends, Carey Lander, from the band Camera Obscura, who died of sarcoma, and her mother, who also died of cancer. And I just wanted to let you know that Sally and her mother were estranged for a long time, and we talk about grieving and death when you haven't been in touch with the family member, in case that is a difficult topic for anyone listening. Thank you. Welcome to Griefcast. I'm here today with writer and broadcaster Sally Hughes. Hello.
Hello, thanks for having me.
I'm very excited, Sally, to have you.
Well, I'm excited to be here in this
Hopefully.
Tiny little hole.
I know, tiny little hole. Your spelling of Sally, I just is the Welsh spelling.
It is.
Are you from Wales originally?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm from Wales originally.
Yeah, born and bred.
Oh, so we have like the opposite. Well, as in my name is extremely Welsh, but grew up in London and I disappoint Welsh people quite a lot. They get very, because obviously you must know, you're obviously used to the word cariad then, I'm guessing.
Yeah, yeah, completely. So your name poses absolutely no problem to me whatsoever. I don't think it's remotely weird. But my name throws people all the time.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to say, because people don't realise it's Welsh. They must not think it's the Welsh spelling.
I think people assume it's immediate affectation. Which is with really a little, annoying.
Like, heart over the eye or
especially
something.
Especially since Sally S-A-L-I is an older name than Sally S-A-L-L-Y.
Oh, is it?
And so people think I've adapted proper Sally as they see it. But in fact, my name is much older.
What does it mean in Welsh?
So it appears in the Mabinogion.
Oh, love the Mabinogion, straight to my heart, Sally. Yeah. Amazing.
So Sally appears in the Mabinogion and it is a diminutive of Sarah and Sian and names like that.
Oh, wow. Kind of, yeah. If you don't know the Mabinogion, guys, it's pretty fucking good.
Yeah, it's quite mental, the Mabinogion. Yeah, it's quite trippy. It's a bit Game of Thrones, isn't it?
It is very Game of Thrones, actually. Yeah, it's sort of like ancient Welsh text that a lot of the King Arthur legends come from. And it's sort of like Tales from the Court, basically, isn't it?
It's quite bonkers and fantastical. Yeah, so my mother read the Mabinogion while she was pregnant with me and chose it.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I think it's a lovely name.
Thanks.
Where does the other Sally come from then? Do you know?
It's English Sally from English Sarah. Sally. It's a diminutive of Sarah.
Oh, I see, but your one is older.
Yeah.
I think Welshness is still quite confusing for some people, which I find really bizarre as somebody who's half Welsh with an extremely Welsh name. And I was saying this the other day on another show, like, I was in LA and someone genuinely didn't know. Like, they couldn't even understand what I was saying because I was saying, oh, it's a Welsh name. That's why it's confusing for you. And they were like, where's Wales? And I was like...
Yeah, it's mad, isn't it? And quite often they'll say to me, even if they do know what Wales is in America, they'll say, do you know Tom Jones? As though they might know Madonna or something.
The worst I had recently, I said, oh, you know, like, you know, Anthony Hopkins. And someone went, he's Welsh. And I was like,
wow.
Oh!
He's like, so Welsh.
Yes. I was like, excuse me.
And Michael Sheen.
Yeah.
He's so Welsh.
That's the ones I go for. Michael Sheen, Andy Hopkins, Richard Burton. So it's kind of, I feel like...
Church they often know in America.
Yeah, do they?
Because she was a child sensation,
of course, I completely forgot that.
Yeah.
In my head, she's still, when she came back with that like slightly poppy version, I forget that she did the classical stuff.
Was it Crazy...
Yes.
Crazy Chick.
Yes.
Yeah. It was a banging record,
actually.
It was a
good track. It was a really good track.
I love Charlotte Church. I think she's such a force for good. I went to see her late night pop dungeon show last year and it was brilliant. It's the most fun you can have. She basically plays pop classics in sort of dungeony venues with a full band and they wear kind of mad feather boas and fur coats and wigs and stuff. It's just so much fun. I honestly not ironically suggest
that
everybody goes there. It's the most fun you can have at a gig. It's great.
Well, it's nice to have something uplifting to begin us with. It's obviously, we're going somewhere else today. So who are we remembering today? We're not Charlotte Church, obviously.
Well, I mean, I sort of leave a litter of corpses behind me. There are so many people dead.
You're in the right place, Sally. This is the right place for it.
So both my parents are dead.
Oh, wow, both of them?
My father died when I had just given birth to my first son. So that made me fully deranged for some time. And then my mother died last October. We had a very, very difficult relationship. And hadn't actually spoken for 13 years until she became terminally ill. And then one of my best friends died 3 years ago, Carrie, and she died really young. She died in her early 30s. So, yeah, everyone keeps dying on me these days.
Well,
I think about death constantly. Yeah, well, it's like a massive theme in my life.
This is the right place. The year we had, like, I don't know, something ridiculous, like 8 funerals. And my mum used to say every time the phone rings, who's it now? Like, who's dead now? It just became this utter... And then you were just like getting the black dress ready.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, sure. This is what's going to happen.
Yeah.
So how old were you when your dad died?
So my son's about to turn 14, so I was 30.
Okay, so yeah, young. And what did he die? Was it sudden?
So he did that thing that I think lots of men do, which is that he was a very heavy smoker, a very heavy drinker. He was an alcoholic, I think we can fairly say, and a chain smoker. And he's one of those men who had never, ever, ever been to the doctor. And then the minute his hand was forced, I think he had something wrong with his foot. and my brother made him call the doctor. And then the minute the doctor arrived, he just sort of looked and went, oh, Jesus fucking Christ, you've got 300 things wrong with you. I have no idea how you're alive. He was taken into hospital. And then that evening, my brother called me and said, yeah, he's going to die imminently. And so I was going home the next morning to see him, and he didn't make it through the night. And so I think that happens to lots of men. They so avoid dealing with their suspected ill health that they just get worse and worse and worse until they're riddled with all sorts of things, which I think is what happened to my father. He was quite an old dad, though, my dad. I think he was 78 when he died, and I was 30. So he was quite an old dad when he had me.
So you were on your way back. So you were pregnant at that point, or you just had...
I just had, I think, my first son, Marvin, was 12 weeks old.
Oh, that is
maybe 10
rough.
Weeks.
Yeah. That is rough. So you're already all over the shop anyway.
10 weeks, yeah. It was 10 weeks. Yeah, and it made me completely, completely mental. Mm. Because I think what happened... Well, there's another type of bereavement that was going on at the same time, which I don't feel many people talk about. I was already grieving. I was already suffering a massive bereavement for the fact that I wasn't at work because I had had a baby.
Yeah.
And truly, that was a bereavement. I felt as though someone had died. I was so lonely and depressed not being at work because my whole life, I'd left home when I was 14, so my entire life had been defined by... going to work, my professional achievements, my self-confidence was so laced in with that.
Yeah.
And so I wasn't working. So I already felt pretty nuts. I had a baby and then my father died. And so it was very hard to unpick the various layers because I think I had postnatal depression, the physical bereavement of my father and the kind of metaphorical bereavement of my career, or at least so I thought. And I went really, really mad. It was the most mad I have ever felt, to the point where I genuinely thought I was going insane and became incredibly paranoid and never left the house. And it was just really weird, became quite agoraphobic, went on for months. And in the end, I went to therapy and ended up going for 3 years. And that was hugely, hugely helpful. But to this day, I don't really know. I can't really work out where one thing began and the other ended, because it was are we allowed to swear? It was a clusterfuck.
Oh yeah, you are allowed to swear. Yeah, yeah.
it was a clusterfuck and of these incredibly kind of monumental life-changing events.
Yeah.
And they all happened while my hormones were raging and I'd just given birth and it was bloody awful. So that took me a while to get over.
Yeah, and it's, I think we've talked about in the show a lot of like having children, it is a huge life-changing experience. And obviously if you haven't had children, that doesn't mean your life is less enriched. It's just having children is mental and very life-changing, and losing a parent is very life-changing, extremely life-changing obviously. And then to have both those things sort of crash into each other,
well, and also they're sort of the same thing in that you lose a parent and become a parent in quick succession, or in my case the other way around. And so your entire kind of belief system or understanding of what it means to a parent becomes incredibly confused, and you're sort of full of regret about how you've been parented or how you've been a child to somebody else, and then you have to try and pay it forward in a more healthy way and all that stuff. It's incredibly, incredibly confusing. So, and the other thing that happened with my father that I found incredibly difficult, and partly why I ended up in therapy, was everybody trying to be nice said, make sure you grieve. And it did my head in, because all I used to think is, what does that mean? Yeah. You don't even know what that means. I don't know what that means. What is grief? Like, I don't know. I tried to work it out for something that I'd written, and with the benefit of hindsight, I was able to do better than at the time. But at the time, you just feel shit. And it didn't feel like a process to me. It just felt like a condition.
Yeah, yeah.
And that process that people talk about just seems to be plucked out of thin air. It doesn't really seem to mean anything.
No, I don't think it does mean anything. And the thing I sort of always try and say to people is, like, just be nice to yourself. Like, because whatever you're feeling, and it might not be... you know, I think what people expect is like, oh, grieving equals I'm crying all the time, I'm sad. Yeah. And it might not be that. And so then people get into this guilt cycle of like, oh, well, I'm just walking around feeling very numb. Is that wrong? Or I feel fine. Is that wrong? And you're like, no, none of these things are wrong. You just have to, whatever you're feeling, make sure that you're okay and you're feeling it.
I think that's good advice. I think that is the most you can do. And it's also what I try to do to other people when I know other people are grieving in however that looks for them. I just try to assume that they're not okay. I think that's...
That's a nice
way
of putting it.
I think we take our cues from the person who is bereaved. And I think we look for quite obvious cues.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I didn't particularly feel supported when my father died. I didn't really particularly feel that anybody was really there for me. And I'm sure that they would have wanted to have been. But because I wasn't sobbing all the time, I think people just assumed I was fine. In fact, latterly, there was an incident a couple of weeks after my father died. And we had the naming party for the baby.
Gosh.
And my friends came and they got extremely, extremely jolly and out of hand, even though I'd asked them not to. Anyway, I ended up losing my temper and saying, you know, how could you do this? And I remember one of my friends saying, we thought you were fine. And I remember saying, but... And she's a really good friend. She's still a really good friend of mine. We didn't fall out long term, but she said, we thought you were fine. And I said, but my dad died 2 weeks ago, so yeah, I reckon, like, take a guess. Like, yeah. I think probably take a punt on me not being fine.
Yeah.
But because I hadn't cried at them and because I hadn't sobbed at them and said, oh my God, I'm, you know, and thrown myself on coffins and things, I think they thought, well, Sally's very strong, she's fine, but actually no one's fine.
No, I think that's such an important thing to remember, that the picture of grief, that,
yeah,
whatever that comes from your Hollywood ideal or what you've seen other people do of sobbing and throwing yourself in a coffin, if someone isn't doing that, it doesn't mean they're okay. And also, plus, even if your father had been alive and well, don't get drunk at a christening because you just had a baby and it's really stressful. But like, on top of that, like, if someone's lost a parent 2 weeks, of course they're not fine. But I think so many people want people to be fine so badly. It's like believing in magic. It's like you want it so badly. So if someone presents even a hint of it to you, you go...
You'll take it.
I'll take it.
100%.
Sally's standing up. She not crying. Great. She's fine. That means I can have a drink and I'm not going to die. You know what? I think we're all not going to die. Like, it's so much about everyone's fear.
I think
fear
it's absolutely
it.
That. If you give people the opportunity not to do anything, they will not do anything. And I think for the most part, the thing I've learned with other people is just assume that they're not okay.
Mm.
And don't ask them if they need anything, and don't ask them if they need any help, because they definitely, that then becomes their responsibility, and
yeah,
they definitely won't act on it because there's too much going on. You have to impose yourself in quite a low-key way, I
yes.
think.
Yeah, yeah.
I think you have to leave food on the doorstep, and I think you have to send a text every day and
yep.
not expect a reply. And I think you just need to let somebody know that you see them and that you hear them and that you are ready, you are poised.
For whenever they are,
yeah.
yeah.
And I think that's really all that's required. And the other thing that people need to do, and this never fails to amaze me, every time somebody has died on me, I've always been completely perplexed by this, but why don't people simply say, oh my God, that is fucking shit. just say it.
That is fucking bullshit. Yeah.
I am really sorry that that's happened to you. That sucks more than anything mm-hmm. I can think of. That absolutely blows. That is all you have to say. You don't
yeah.
have to put a spin on it. You don't have to.
Yeah. Oh, well, she would have and they would have. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Don't spin it. Don't try and come up with kind of platitudes for it. Just say, fucking hell, that's horrible.
Mm.
That is really horrible
yeah.
and you must feel shit, because people just want to be heard, I think.
Yeah, and there's something so, like, refreshing when someone says that to you. I know...
I love it.
Carrie Quinlan said that in her episode, that I think she went to the pub after her dad had died, and I think this is right, correct me if I'm wrong, Carrie, that Marcus Brigstocke just put his hand on her and was like, that's fucking shit. She laughed, was like,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you. Because
yeah.
everyone else, the spin makes you feel that your internal feelings are wrong. Because you think, this is so shit, everyone's like, wow, You know, and I've talked about before, like, because my dad was young and very healthy and was training for an Ironman and running marathons,
wow.
Everyone was like, God, he would have hated to be sick so long. It's good it was quick. And I remember thinking,
it's not shit.
Is it? No, like, I think it's quite shit that it,
yeah.
But a minute ago he was alive and yeah. I said, I think that's awful that somebody yeah. so healthy is now gone.
It's like a horrible, violent
yeah,
shock, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, and you're in shock, but... And I understand it's people, like we said, it's as ever looking for a narrative that soothes them. But I think you're so, the freedom of the truth of like, it's awful. That's awful. God,
and for someone
awful.
To let you know that they are listening, that they are looking at you and hearing you and not trying to self-soothe.
Yes, that's so true. Yeah.
That's the act of kindness, isn't it? That's
yeah.
sort of not trying to get yourself off the hook. It's just going, yes, I'm here, and seeing your visceral agony.
Yeah.
And that's such a powerful thing.
Yeah, and I think you're so right. Like, the self-soothing, even though you can understand it as a fellow human, for someone to go, I'm not going to make myself feel better, I'm just going to look you in the eye and be like, ooh, this is awful.
Yeah.
And then you can... Because I think what people worry is like, oh, don't let her know it's awful. Perhaps she hasn't realised. Like, perhaps if we paint a nice picture, she'll feel better. And you don't. You know your life is shit. You know you're looking at it and you're like, this is really shit. So, and a friend does that and is acknowledging how shit it is. It hurts, but in a good way.
I tell you what I found incredibly powerful and comforting, not when my father died, but later on when my friend died, was friends who... were furious,
yeah.
like who really shared in my anger, and that made me feel so much better because I was really angry yeah. when Carrie died because she was too young, and it just was so unjust, and I was so cross about it. And so friends who were like, "What the fuck?" like really yeah. angry, I felt so supported by them and given sort of permission to feel my irrational rage. It's just another way of letting people know. I've got you. I accept however you're feeling is the yeah. right way to feel. And I share in it because I love you. I think that's such a powerful thing to say to someone.
And what did Carrie die of?
She died of osteosarcoma, which is quite rare. So it's basically cancer of the bone.
I think this is what... sorry to switch episodes.
Julia Rayside's
brother. Julia Rayside's
brother,
yes. though, because she mentions that Carrie when on her episode.
Yeah. So Colin Rayside, Julia's yeah. brother, and Carrie died in the same year of the same thing. Oh. Julia's a very good friend of mine. And so that's why when we got married, instead of us, Julia and I didn't get married. I married a man called Dan, although I would marry Julia. But
she'd be a great wife.
Yeah, I think she's probably a very good shag. Dan and I, when we got married, we raised, instead of having a wedding list, we raised money for Sarcoma UK in Colin and Carrie's name because Julia is a close friend. But it's bizarre, actually, that I know two who...
Yeah, yeah.
And actually, one of Julia's best friends, Jerome, also died of osteosarcoma.
Yes, she said, yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
it's bizarre that there are three people in my life, but it has a very high mortality rate and it affects mainly people under 45.
And how old did you say Carrie was?
So she was 31.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, it was just total shit. And so she got cancer 3-4 years before that. And because of the nature of osteosarcoma, she had to go to hospital. She basically lived in hospital for about a year having chemo and it went away. And I remember her saying to me when she was in remission that she thought every day about the fact that she thought it would come back. And I remember thinking, no, it won't. Yeah. And I think that's why I was so furious, because I'm not a catastrophist at all. And I have friends who are catastrophists and I find it quite annoying when they're catastrophizing things. I'm like, oh, well, you know, you'll deal with it when it comes.
Yeah.
And because I'm not a catastrophist and she always thought it would come back and I was so sure it wouldn't. Or, you know, not deluded, but positive generally yeah. about it. That on my 40th birthday, she came to my 40th birthday party and she said that she'd been having some pains and she felt like it was coming back. And then sure enough, very shortly afterwards, she went to the hospital and it had come back. And then in the summer, we got the terminal diagnosis. And yeah, I felt so furious. I'm still quite angry about it.
I think that's fair enough.
It's just really unfair. And I remember when I went to... So what happened was, towards the end of her life, so she lived in Glasgow, She was the keyboardist in the band Camera Obscura.
Yeah, and I was just going to say, a brilliant, wonderful band as
well. Yeah, they're fantastic.
So their music is, yeah, if you don't know them, obviously go and find it. It's still there.
And they're deeply, deeply good people as well. Carrie's best friend in the entire world is Tracy Ann, the lead singer. Like amazing friends, basically sisters. And because Carrie was up there for the last probably 6, 7, 8 weeks of her life, I spent every week probably 3 or 4 days of every week in Glasgow. My husband, bless him, just held the fort for half the week while I went there to be with her. And I remember one day I was in a Glasgow hotel and I was on my way to the hospital or something to see her. And my paper, I was just leaving my hotel room and my newspaper had been pushed through the door. And my next door neighbour in the hotel, their newspaper was still on the doorstep thing. And they had the Daily Mail. And no judgment, but massive judgment. And Katie Hopkins is on the cover spaffing on about some Katie Hopkins bullshit. And I lost my temper because I thought, why do you get to be alive? Why do you get to be alive when my friend is definitely going to die really, really soon? And actually, I think that's quite healthy. After, for the year around her death, I used to list people who shouldn't be alive in my head.
Like Arya Stark.
Yeah. But actually, it's quite soothing. It's a bit like the really dark version of your lottery fantasy. You know, when you know, when you think, oh, where would we live? Would we get a crash pad here? What would we do? You know, where would we go on holidays? It's like the very dark, macabre version of that where you're like, okay, so who, if I had to kill 10 people to make Carrie live, who would I kill? And actually, you sort of have to give yourself space to have those thoughts because I am furious about it. And she was more deserving of life, I think, than somebody who spends their life being horrible to people.
Yeah, no, and I agree with you.
I think that's okay to think that.
I find something really, something that I can put my feet down, grounding, about the way that life exists like that. Because that's obviously how I feel. You know, my dad died when I was 15 and I look at other dads who are shit or my friends who don't appreciate their dads or just shit parents. And you think, well, how comes that happened? And I just go, that's life? Like, that's life?
Yeah.
And something about that makes me go, there is just no justice. Which means...
there is none.
Which means you don't have to... not, and that doesn't mean you don't have a moral code. You should have a moral code because your actions do have consequences. But it's sort of a freeingness of like, well, people just die at random. And so you can't really...
They really do. And I think that's such a good point because my whole life I have a particular hatred, and I have since I was a child, I have a particular hatred of people who say everything happens for a reason. Because it doesn't. Things don't happen for a reason. They just fucking happen.
Yeah.
And I really, really, really believe in luck. I believe in good luck, bad luck. And if you're really lucky, neither, just an unexceptional existence, but it is chance. You can't control it. All you can do in life is wait for some good luck and exploit it and work hard at it and hammer it into the ground. I really think that's all you can do. And luck is massively, massively important. And so when people say, well, everything happens for a reason, well, no, I run a charity and there are people we look after in that charity who are born into rotten, rotten luck. Mm. And their chances of succeeding within the framework of their family,
cultural
care system, education system, geography, all of that stuff is so, so, so slim. They're just really, really, really short on luck. And if they got a bit of luck, then one likes to think that they could then exploit it. But that's a whole other tier of privilege that lots of people don't have. And that thing you're talking about with your dad and just thinking there is no justice, I also sort of find that freeing because people need to stop thinking that, you know, good things happen to good people and bad things happen. They don't. They don't. Good things happen to bad people all the time.
Yeah, they really do. I think, like, that's the thing. Is I sort of separate it from morality because I think, like, if you want a nice life, like, it's nice to be nice to people. Like, that will be helpful. And that will, you know, if you're nice to someone, they might help you later. That's not why you should be nice to someone. But, like, that feeling of, like, oh, karma and everything happens for a reason, I think there's a definite space for it. But that's... But that's more like the nice things, you know, like if you're nice to your friend and you lend her something, she might lend you something you need. Like,
exactly.
But like,
it's a practical, transactional thing.
And it's like nice to feel nice and live in a community of people who are being polite to you on the bus. But well, when it comes to
when I die, I want people to think fondly of me.
Yeah, sure.
I want people to think I was nice.
Yeah.
I want people to think I was a good person. I want my kids to think I was a nice mum.
Yeah.
I want their lives to have been enhanced by my parenting and mothering, not held back by it. Those are the things that stuff really matters. That's enough.
Yeah,
I think.
But it won't protect you from death.
No.
Or bad luck.
No.
That's what I think is. I think people then translate that into I can protect myself from the fundamentals of life because I'm a good person, you know, or the bad people will die. And you just go, there's so many examples of the bad people not dying.
Well, and the problem with that is then there's a layer of implication that people dying in the Sudan or people who died in the Holocaust just weren't thinking positively enough or just weren't spreading the love. It's like, no, just like really horrible things happen.
And I think what I like about it is if you accept really horrible things happen, you can also accept really amazing things happen exactly at the same time. And it sounds sort of gloomy, but I think it isn't gloomy. It's sort of, you sort of realise, like, yeah, that's life. These brilliant people like Harry, who were just obviously lovely and talented and very loved, die. And that's just, like you said, it's just shit.
It's really, shit. Really unfair. And life is really, really unfair. But I agree with you. I don't think that's a massively negative realisation. Mm. I think it's realistic and it allows you to, I think it allows you to do lots of things. It allows you to celebrate small victories, which I think is incredibly important. I think we delay celebrations and we just keep moving the goalposts. But actually, then you can die before you've reached your goal. Actually, there are so many little wins along the way that matter.
Yes,
it's sort
definitely.
Of, you know, in my case or in your case, it's, you know, a glass of wine because you've finished writing a thing
or
another glass of wine when you've had a positive meeting about the thing or a nice walk out when that thing is produced or well received. And you just have to break it down, because at which point do you stop modifying your goals to be bigger and less attainable? I think you delay celebration. If you delay celebration, there is every chance you'll be dead.
I really agree. Life's too short. Yeah, that sort of old adage, I think, has weight. And how did you feel when Carrie died? Did you feel, because we've talked about this a bit on the show, of like grieving as a friend is a really, not tricky, but it's an unusual space because you're not family. And then so sometimes what we've talked about on the show is people sort of think, to quote you earlier, you're fine because it wasn't your sister. You know, they kind of limit your grief or soften it slightly. How was it after Carrie died?
Do you know, weirdly, I think the people I know found it easier to deal with because I am the person who is not close to her family.
Right.
And I am known in my circle of friends to be the person from the very complicated, unrelatable family. I mean, there are exceptions. I do have some close friends who are just from absolute bin fire families. But mostly I am seen as the person from the family that nobody really understands, and they don't really know what grief would look like within that framework.
Oh, I see.
And so...
Whereas your relationship with Carrie is simpler.
Whereas my relationship with my friends is incredibly strong. So I'm a very loyal and devoted friend. And my friends really are my family.
Right,
they're my chosen family. And so I think my friends were much better able to imagine that I was in a real state over Carrie than they were over my parents.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
They understood it more, I think. Nobody really knew what to say about either of my parents.
Yeah, and perhaps, like you said, because some families are complicated, whereas friendships can be, I've chosen this person.
Yes.
So we really like each other, and that's kind of it.
Yeah.
They like me, I like them.
Yeah.
Whereas family is like, oh, well, yeah, as we know from the show, it's not always a simple story.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome back to Griefcast with Carrie Adloyd.
So your mum only died last year?
Mm-hmm.
I'm just trying to work out. Oh, right, so you haven't even had a year then, have you? Like, yeah.
No, so she died in October.
October. And what did she die of?
She died of cancer. So she died of... So she had breast cancer several years ago during our period of estrangement, actually. And we didn't actually have anything to do with one another during the first bout of cancer. She had radiotherapy. It went away. And a lumpectomy and stuff, and it went away. And then... I was on holiday last July, I think 13 years into our estrangement, and my brother phoned me and said that her cancer was back and it had spread to her head, neck, lungs, everywhere, and she was definitely going to die. And so that was quite a weird thing. I then had to decide what I was going to do about it. If anything, and I did consider doing nothing about it, I must say. And then she and I exchanged some emails. We had our first contact in many, many years.
Did you start? Did you send the first email?
No. I was going to, but I was trying to pluck up the courage when she did.
Yeah.
So she contacted me first. We exchanged a few emails. I told her about my children. She'd never met one of my sons.
Wow.
She'd met my younger son, who's 12.
Did the estrangement, so your dad, did it happen after your dad died? Sorry, my maths is so bad.
Yes, but it did happen in the immediate aftermath of my father dying. But the complicated thing about my mother and me is that although we'd had 13 years of non-stop estrangement, there had been clusters of 2 years here, 3 years there. It had been an on-off estrangement.
Yeah, it didn't come out of the blue.
No, there wasn't like some big feud or row. It's not really about that. It's not about being in a strop or a punishment or anything at all. I now run a support group online for people who embark on necessary family estrangement. It's not really, it's not sudden. It's a real kind of slow burning decision. And so there had been 2 years here, three there, five there, whatever. 13 was the longest. So we exchanged quite a few emails. I was quite honest about some things. I said, so obviously she contacted me and said that her cancer was back and it was terminal and she was definitely 100% going to die. And in fairness, she said, I would really like to see you, but I completely respect if you don't want to see me. Mm. And it was quite an honest conversation. It's difficult to describe because I think, you know, it's tempting for me within the sort of framework of a conversation or a podcast to say there was this moment of clarity. Yeah. There wasn't really. There wasn't a big reconciliation, but there was definitely more honesty than there ever had been. And there was some quite blunt conversation. I said, I always thought, I just always thought you didn't like me. And she said, I can see why you thought that, which is quite a big thing. Mm. And I said, I always felt let down by you. I felt that you were never there for me. And she said, I can see why you thought that. You know, and it was just, and it was quite a bizarre, because I had tried to say these things in the past and they had made her furious. But she acknowledged them and she took them on board. And so that was, it wasn't a big dramatic moment, but it was a significant moment. Yeah, and it was significant enough for me to think, actually, I will see her. And I also thought I would see her for my brothers, because I didn't want them to feel that I just lumped them with this dying mother and I just absolved myself of responsibility. So it was as much for them, really.
And so how many brothers do you have then?
I have four brothers.
Whoa!
Yeah.
And are they obviously, they have extremely different relationships, all siblings do. But yeah, I can understand.
They were all in touch with her.
Right, yeah.
And so I didn't want to abandon them with this huge thing.
Yeah, and just the process of someone dying is a huge thing.
And I guess she was at home until the end. And
you've been through that with your dad. So, yeah, you are aware of what a death does.
Yeah, and it was, I think it lasted, the whole thing lasted all the way through the summer. So it was July I got the call and then she died in October and she was home the whole time dying, basically. And so I thought I should... I didn't want them, my siblings, to think I was a bad person. But, it's very difficult. I think it would have... People ask me about this all the time on my estrangement group, which is called Necessary Family Estrangement on Facebook. People ask me all the time, because they know I've been through it. They say, oh, my dad's terminally ill or my mother's terminally ill. Should I see her? And I actually think either is fine. I don't think that it's a bad thing to not see them. I think you just have to work out how much work you've already done on yourself. Whether you'll be fine for there to be no big moment, how you're likely to react to the moment either way. And I think, to be honest, being estranged out of choice from a close family member is a death already.
Yeah.
And I think that I had done most of my grieving many years ago. And so... Although I definitely didn't want her to die, and I'm very sad that she died, and I'm very sad for my brothers, and it was a horrible and upsetting thing for them and for her, and frightening and all of that stuff. And I really, really, really wish I could have made it not happen. I definitely didn't want it to happen. However, I think I had done a substantial amount of grieving when she was still alive and well. And also I had grieved the fact that I hadn't really been parented. And so it wasn't so much that I'd grieved her as a mother. I had already dealt with the fact that I hadn't been parented. And actually, when she did die, what was odd about it, and I think the way I grieved her was quite selfish, really. But again, I don't feel so guilty about it. But I think for me, there was quite a lot involved in the window of opportunity in which I could have been parented as a person had now closed permanently. Mm. Both my parents were dead.
Yeah.
I would never know the thing that other people talk about. I just don't have any experience of the thing that people talk about. And so I think it was a very slow grief. I suppose the only time I've ever kind of felt any parallels with a different situation is sometimes I speak to somebody whose parent had dementia or Alzheimer's, where they have this very long, gradual, drawn out process of grief, and then someone dies. It's a bit like that. I think I had lots of therapy and lots of crying and lots of rowing with her and all of that stuff. And so I think by the time she died, I had done a large part of the grief over my mother.
I think that makes a lot of sense. I think that it's amazing that you run that group. I think it's really important. And we've talked about this on the show before, of like, I think sometimes people think like, and I have this sort of like, oh, she does a podcast about her dad, and because it was like, she must really miss him. It's like, it was such a deeply complicated relationship.
Really?
Yeah, oh God, yeah. And I think sometimes the narrative's quite easy of like,
yeah,
daddy's girl, I miss him so
it's
much.
It's just a huge tragedy. You were a little girl and daddy, yeah.
And no. And like, my mum always says he'd find it quite amusing that you're actually sort of talking about him, because when he was alive, I would have never allowed him to believe he had any effect on me whatsoever. And we had a difficult relationship, and yeah, complicated and difficult. I mean, it wasn't like, you know, like Mike Lee wouldn't be calling me to like dramatise it, but it wasn't, it definitely wasn't sweet, and I definitely wasn't daddy's girl, even though he would buy badges and ask me to wear them, and I would be like, this is gross. Like, no, I'm not your daddy's girl. And so I think it's so important for people to understand, like, you can have a complicated relationship and still feel things or not feel things. Like, I would say from all the episodes we've done, it's like I can count on one hand the people who were like, I just love them and they loved me and then they died. Like,
well, it's funny because one of my closest girlfriends, her father died last year. She's like roughly my age, and her beloved, beloved, adored father died just before Christmas. And she, just after my mother died, in fact, and she and I have talked about this lots, where she has said, I am so devastated and I'm so broken and I'm so completely not all right. However, I'm grateful because it's so simple.
Yeah.
And she is so heartbroken, but there's such a simplicity to it.
Yes,
is quite freeing, and because she just gets to be really gutted.
Yeah.
You know, she just gets to be incredibly sorrowful
and
sad and weepy. And she finds that lack of complexity a relief, a blessed relief. And I really get that. Like her entire family, they're just bloody gutted. He was a great dad.
He was a great person.
And now he's gone. They didn't want him to go. And they just really, really miss him.
Yeah.
And there is something to be said for that simplicity, that you can just be anguished and sad.
Yeah. And
you,
I
know,
think,
what that is.
Yeah. And I've spoken to, like, you know, it's, I would say like this handful of episodes where the story's so simple when I interview them, because it's just like, oh, they were really great and I really love them and they really love me and they died. And I can see, I'm like, wow, that's
yeah,
it,
what
isn't
does
it?
That feel like?
Yeah, yeah. Like, what is that? That's interesting, because it's just, it's really beautiful. And I suppose, you know, as ever, things are a spectrum, and you can see, like, that is like at the top of the spectrum in a way of like, that's sort of the ideal of a parent-child situation where you just love them and it's, they know that and they feel safe and protected. And that's, you know, obviously there's, as you said, cultural and educational and social privileges that allow those things to happen that some people just don't have access to. But it is interesting. And I think most people aren't up there because everything's a spectrum. And it's, I have a friend who is estranged from her mother, and it is a really, it's really complicated. And I know that she, often feels very frustrated that people don't understand. And one of the things that people throw at her quite a lot, which I have done, it just,
what about when she dies?
What about when she dies?
Yeah.
And I always say to her, I'm just checking that you're sure. I'm not saying your decision is right or wrong. I just want to know that you've definitely thought.
Yeah.
And she's like, you know, yes, of course I have. But she said, you know, it's a weird thing that people throw at you of like, oh, well, that's when it suddenly, it will change or it suddenly matters. And, you know, she's like, as if I took it lightly, as if like, well, I'll just wait till she's dying.
Your friend is absolutely right. Everything you've just quoted her as saying is absolutely right. But I would also add to that, in that, of course, I've had that a million times. Mm. That is the thing that people say.
Yeah.
They say, oh, well, what about when she dies? But it's sort of the wrong question, because obviously the answer is, I'll be gutted.
I'll
be absolutely gutted. Mm. It's not a choice. It's not saying, I'll just be breezy without them in my life.
I'm actually fine.
I'm actually great without them in my life, and I'll be great when they're dead. That's not it.
Yeah.
The choice you're making is not to surrender your life when they're alive in order to feel that level of peace when they're dead.
Mm.
You have to weigh it up and think, well, I'm alive now. They're alive now. What does that take away from my life to have them involved in it? And can you, is that a mitigating factor in then what happens later on when they die? You know you're going to be gutted. There's no way of avoiding that. But what you can avoid is unhappiness now. That's the only bit you get to control. You're going to be devastated no matter what when they're gone. But you can't control that. The bit you can control is how you feel in your living life and their living life. And if they take away more from your life than they add to it, then you might need to consider removing them from your life.
Yeah, and I think what's hard, and I've said this to her as well, like, I think this is true for all situations. People always relate it from themselves. So often when they're saying, oh, what about their dad? When they die, they're thinking, oh, I'd be so sad if my mum died and I hadn't spoken to her.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, well, that's you and your mum, which is a different relationship. And I think it's really important. You always have to realise people see through their own glasses, you know? So it's like they can only relate to their relationship with their mother or their father. And, you know, I feel like that when talking about my dad, like sometimes people are like, oh, you must have been crushed when he died. And I'm like, oh, it isn't that simple, because our relationship was difficult. But I can see what they're saying is, I really love my daddy so much. And if I'd been 15...
I think that thing, though, of people seeing it through their glasses of an incredibly loving and supportive parent, the only way you can really turn that around is to say to them, OK, well, you have an incredibly loving and supportive mother, and you can't imagine how awful it would be for her to die and think you don't like her. Imagine your incredibly loving and supportive mother, how she would feel if you were making a decision that made every day of your life an unhappy day. She loved you. She loves you so much, she would hate you to be miserable. So how do you think she would feel about you not making a decision that would make you happier? And that's the only way they can see it. If they can only see it through a loving parent, ask them how their loving parent would feel if they were miserable every day.
Yeah.
And that is how lots of people feel
in that situation.
Yeah
And I think as well, it's just some families are, like you said, deeply complicated, and I've had to learn that with her, and I've had to definitely change the way I think about things, because I was very much at the beginning of like, but you know, I'd be so sad, and I know what it's like when someone dies. You got to grab all these moments, and that's coming from my place of regret of like, I didn't have that chance with my dad because I was too young, and we didn't get to fix what probably was. This is the difference. My dad's relationship with me probably was fixable with time.
Yeah.
And that's my pain.
Yeah.
Like, that's totally my pain of like, I think it would have more time. It never would have been
you
perfect.
You feel a sense of unfinished business.
Yeah, it never would have been perfect because our personalities, but definitely I think we would have got much better. And that's not true for some people. It doesn't matter how much time have, it's not going to get fixed or be in a better place. And I think that's, hard for sometimes, like you said, people have been lovingly parented to get their heads around, because they always see this like, but it'll be okay, and they love
you. You pass a deadline, I think, where things can be changed, and that's very sad. But I know when my mother was dying, and I visited her a few times, like a handful of occasions, I drove home to Wales and was with her. It's funny, there wasn't a big moment where suddenly everything was okay. We couldn't really talk to one another very well.
Yeah.
We both were incredibly awkward in one another's company. I couldn't be physical. I don't recall a single time in my life where my mother gave me a kiss or hugged me. And so I can't just suddenly start doing it at 44. And she couldn't either, and that's okay. You know, I think I did it, and I think it was the right decision. However, I think your expectation, you have to manage your own expectations.
Yes, that's true.
I think people expect in death to be these really huge moments. And sometimes there are, you know, I had one with Carey, but actually, on the whole, you don't, because people are still themselves even when they're dying.
Yeah, it doesn't matter what happens, you're still you.
Yeah.
That's what me and my friend Sarah Pascoe always say.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what happens, you're still you. So you're still going to react like you do, even if it's a good or a bad thing.
Also, we're British and therefore quite shit.
Yeah, there is also that. So were you with her when she died?
No, I wasn't. I found out from somebody I used to go to school with.
Oh, wow.
Which was actually quite gutting. I felt quite gutted about that. But yeah, I was going to go home in a couple of days, and then my brother said, I think it's soon. But there had been a few false alarms of that nature, and then the next morning somebody I'd gone to school with had been told before me, and she told me, which I think she was absolutely mortified by. So no, I wasn't there. I was at home in Brighton with my kids.
And then did you go back for the funeral?
Yes, I did go back for the funeral. And that was quite odd, because when friends of mine have lost members of their family, I always say, I'll come to the funeral.
Mm.
And I think it's quite an important part of friendship to volunteer meaningfully to go to the funeral. Because when my father died, a number of my friends came, and I felt very supported by that.
Yeah.
It really mattered to me that they were there. It really meant a lot to me. But it's funny, because of my estrangement with my mother, I didn't feel I had the right to have friends there.
Yeah.
So my oldest friend from school, Rachel, who has been my best mate since I was 11, she came because she knows the rest of the family.
Yeah.
But several friends offered to come to the funeral, and I just felt I didn't really have the right to have them there, because I haven't paid my dues, do you know what I mean? So,
do you regret that now, or do you think it was just right?
No, I think it was sensitively the right thing to do. So my children came, and my husband came, and my best friend from school came, and that was fine.
Yeah. Yeah. So what was it you, I just trying to, what was it, you just felt like you couldn't turn up with your gang
having
not shown up?
It felt,
that's fair. I see what you're saying.
It felt insensitive and it felt a bit showy.
Yeah.
I just didn't really feel like I had the right to turn up with some entourage because I hadn't put in the hours in the previous years. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
It just felt a bit distasteful, so I didn't do it. So lots of friends offered and I said, no, I'd really rather you didn't come, which I felt bad about because it really did matter to me where my father had died and they were there. But I just kind of had to put my foot down, really.
Yeah, I really understand that. I think what we're getting into is when a relationship is complicated, there are other complicated decisions. Like, it's never like, of course, I need your support. They're lovely and all
this. No, I just thought, I don't own this funeral. I don't own this grief. Yeah. I don't own this sort of atmosphere and this group feeling. I feel quite separate from it. And I think it would be distasteful of me to make it about me. And so I went quite discreetly.
That's very interesting, isn't it? Because in a way that is, like you said, that's the truth of like you have removed yourself from that group and that situation and the dynamics of that. So some things are just very complicated, you know, they just are. And trying to simplify them is never going to, it's never going to work because they're just deeply complicated. How has it been since she died? Like, have you found, I mean, obviously you're like, how do you feel about even using the term the grief for her? Because I guess it maybe does that feel like it doesn't quite...
Again, I don't feel massively entitled to it.
Yeah.
And I don't really know what it is. I don't really know what it looks like. I think, to be completely honest, most of how I feel is to do with me, not her.
Mm.
It's to do with, you know, my own mortality, the similarities between us, the differences between us, my parenting.
Yeah.
I think her death has put me under my own microscope more than a kind of straightforward, I'm so sad that someone's dead.
Mm.
I think it's been a bit more self-centred, to be honest. I'm not proud of that, but that is what it is. It's just how I feel.
I don't think there's anything wrong. I think that's like what death does. And I think that's why when you're at the epicentre of the death, it makes you look at yourself a lot. But there's also what everyone's doing. You know, when like we talked about that self-soothing, everybody is sort of going, wow, how do I feel about these? Because that's what it reminds us, like, we're going to die and who are we as people? And I think especially with your mum and you being a mum and like the complications of the relationship, of course it's, I don't think it's self-centred. I think that's reasonable to have to examine yourself based on that relationship.
I think that the most powerful moment for me in the entire sort of illness, death, mourning period, the number one biggest thing that happened to me was when I agreed to see her, she came to me because she was still mobile at that point. This was in July, August. She came to see me and my children. I had spoken to them in advance and I said, look, do you want to meet her? There is no wrong answer here. Mm. Whatever you decide is A-okay with me. However, I'm going to see her. And if you do decide to see her, whatever you know about our relationship, you have to remember that she's an old lady who's dying and I expect you to act accordingly. And they said, of course, absolutely. Mm. And they decided they wanted to see her. And she came and she was coming at sort of 11 o'clock. And at about 8:30, 9 o'clock, I said to my husband, Dan, oh, can you go and wake the boys up? Because they need to have showers and get sorted out and stuff because it's really, really hard to get my kids out of bed because they're teenagers. Mm-hmm. And it was the summer holidays. They were on a bad rhythm and everything. So I said, oh, can you go and get them out of bed? And he said yes. And he went into their rooms and they were both standing there and they were wearing their wedding outfits that they've worn to my wedding. And Dan said, oh, you're so dressed up. They had like little blazers on and skinny jeans and their nice Converse on and stuff. And Dan said, oh my God, you're all dressed up. And my eldest son said, oh, we just thought Mum would like it. We just thought it'd be nice for Mum. And it was so, I don't know, I just thought it was such a lovely thing.
Mm.
And she came and it was really handy that they were there because, of course, we could do lots of our talking through them and they asked her lots of questions and they helped her up the stairs and stuff and they behaved so beautifully. Like, I was so proud of them and so proud. And I think that was the biggest moment for me of her going and me
thinking I had seen them all day through her eyes, through completely new eyes, in that she was meeting them for the first time. And I thought, whatever it is, whatever the stuff is, whatever the reason for our estrangement, whatever the reasons that I hated my childhood, whatever the reasons I think you've let me down as a parent, all of the stuff I've talked about in therapy and like abuse and neglect and all of the stuff, whatever it is, it's gone. It's over. Like the next bit, my kids don't have that. And it's like, I don't know, it's such a big deal to me. Like if they end up going to therapy, it will be wear and tear. If they end up on a therapist's sofa,
yeah,
I know, and moaning about me, and probably with absolute justification, it will be wear and tear, and they won't be talking about the stuff that I had to talk about. And a line has been drawn in the sand, and a cycle has ceased. And I think her death, that was the biggest thing for me, that I saw them that day and thought, the cycle has ceased. And that's amazing. And I think that's the single most satisfying moment of my life.
I completely understand, because I just think that's all you can do as a parent is go... Yeah. Like, and that is like the weird gift of life, of like, however shit it is, you can somehow hopefully change the things that affected you and then not pass it on. That's all you can do, is not pass on extra shit.
That's literally the whole point, I think, of parenting, that you... Like, you know, I make mistakes all the time. Like, when they were little, I would shout at them and get frustrated and... You know, leave them in front of the telly and like talk to friends. Like all the stuff.
I'm right in the middle of that right now.
Yeah, and all the stuff you feel shit about at the time. Of course, later you realise everybody did it, but you feel so guilty about it. But I have loved this age of having kids because they're really nice. They are really nice. And like they like me and they're good to their friends. They're really nice friends to their friends. And so you see... All of parenting up until they're about 10 is spent thinking you're doing it wrong. And then after 10, there are so, so many opportunities of seeing where you went right. It's really nice.
It's a long game. That's the thing, it's a long game.
It's a really, really long game. Mm. And you can have a laugh with them. And I think to have her there, and bear in mind as well, like I'm not saying my mother was an evil person. She definitely wasn't. But like our mothers had us all really young, didn't they? Mm. And, you know, I don't think she was a very good mother. She knew that I felt that. Everyone in my life knows that I felt that. But she was really young. I think to have her in the house and everything we've been through and the sort of lifelong fucking legacy of it and the amount of talking and the amount of fuck-ups and all of the stuff that relates to my childhood... with two parents who were really bad at it, to see her in the same house as my kids who just don't really have any problems is really nice. They just don't really have any problems. And them being nice to her and knowing what we went through, they were really kind to her.
Yeah.
You know.
And I think that's like you said, it's such a... Like if you were writing it, that's what you'd write. Because it's like, it's a really... For her to see you as a parent and for you to be like, this is what I did... And all of that stuff. And again, I think it's nice. It doesn't have to be, like you said, it doesn't have to be like, so see what I've done, man.
Yeah, no, like it so wasn't that.
It isn't, like you said, it's
the
small...
It was really stilted and awkward.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. It's the small moments of politeness and awkwardness and the cups of tea. And like that is what so much complicated family life is. And I think, and that's, I guess, you know, that's all in that when I speak to my friend and I'm like, are you sure you just... Because that moment was obviously important. But that's not to say, obviously, some people can have will not get that experience at all, and it's important. But I'm really glad that you had that.
Yeah, and I think it's funny. I think it was like my moment of resolution within my grief before anyone had even died. Yeah. And so that was my kind of big light bulb healing moment that maybe people expect themselves to have at the end of a grieving period, but my grieving period has been going on my whole life. It's an odd thing. I really, really hated being a child. I only ever wanted to be an adult. I wished away my childhood. And so it just felt like a kind of closing of a circle, or actually a kind of cessation of a circle in a way. And it was like a really big moment for me. And so for that reason alone, I'm really glad that I did agree to see her before she died, because it gave me that moment's peace. And actually, I think when people are deciding whether they should see a parent who's going to die, who they haven't seen for a long time out of choice, I think you do have to ask yourself, how much unfinished business is there for me? How close am I to finishing off my business? Because I think if there's tons up in the air and you're still a bit shaky, I think it's often the best policy not to see them, because it leaves you with more questions than can ever be answered.
Yeah.
Whereas I think in my case, I decided to see her because I felt pretty much at the end of this sort of journey. I think if I'd been in the eye of the storm, it could have caused absolute fucking chaos.
Yeah, of course, because then you can have a terrible experience and then they die.
Yeah.
And then you're left with, yeah, like you said, a horrific, traumatic last memory rather than...
Exactly so. You know. And I think the most powerful position to be in life, in any situation, is, are you fine either way?
Yeah,
will you cope either way? Will you cope if you get on well? Will you cope if it's a disaster? Like, will you cope? And actually, I knew I could. I would be okay if it went whichever way it went. I think if it's still very raw, I think very often the best thing is to not see somebody.
Yeah. And I think also, like, we come back to what you said of, like, to trust there isn't a right and a wrong. I always say, there isn't a right and wrong, there's only the consequences. And can you handle them?
Yeah.
As you said, like,
so
that's,
much that. Yeah.
That's
can
it,
you
really.
Take it? Can you take the heat?
And if you can't, that's fine. That's totally fine.
It's because, human. Yeah. Like, it's completely normal.
Yeah.
And there are various points in my life where I couldn't have taken it. But actually, by the time, you know, things are good, like I'm happy and I've done the work and all of that stuff. And so I think by the time the opportunity arose, I thought, well, it could go either way, but I will remain the same person at the end of that.
Yeah.
It won't kind of turn me upside down, this experience. But I think it can lots of people, and that's why it's a trickier decision. And I don't think one day someone will be dead and you'll be sad is an argument for anything, because of course you'll be sad.
Yeah, and as ever, it just it's like saying, oh, well, you know, Carrie's dad died at 15 and that's the saddest thing that ever happened. It's like, it's just not that simple.
Mm-hmm.
And one day we all will be dead and someone will be sad. Like, that's
if
the
thing. If you're lucky.
If you're lucky, yeah. If you're lucky. And but even like we said, like, you're still sad that your mum died. Like, there's still a sad, like, that's sad that someone died. You're not like, woohoo, because that's not mostly how most of us work. I don't think anyone really works like that at all. And I think that's important to realise. This, you can be sad, but that doesn't mean, yeah, it's just not that simple. It's just not that simple.
No,
it isn't that simple.
And, you know, it all feeds into ageing as well for me, that people have this really strange idea about me, because one of the columns I write is a beauty column. I think people imagine that I'm, you know, terrified of aging or something, or that I'm terribly looksist about it. I'm really not. I'm really not like that at all. And somebody on Instagram a couple of days ago said, was having a go with me about something, and said, you stupid old woman or something. And I think they said it because they imagined that was the worst thing that I could ever hear.
Because,
and it's not the worst thing, anything close to it for me, because I've seen the alternative, and the alternative is horrible. The alternative is that you die young and you don't get to grow old.
Yeah.
And if you're really lucky, you get a chance to become an old lady. And, you know, lots of people leave too soon and they don't get that opportunity.
Oh, it's very true. Well, Sally, on that note, we should all remember, just to appreciate the fact that you're here right now.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming to talk to me. It was
you're welcome.
Joy. Thank you.
Thanks.
You can follow Sally on Twitter and Instagram at Sally Hughes, and her new book, Our Rainbow Queen, is out now. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at The Griefcast. The show was edited by Kate Holland, with thanks to Whistledown Studios, and the music is provided by The Glue Ensemble. And remember, you are not alone.
Hold up. When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.